This week on Making Contact.
As more and more white people can fight against racial injustice and fight for racial justice from a point of their own self-interest in collective liberation, the more powerful the white portion of movements against racism can be.
White anti-racist activism hasn't been as visible as it was in, say, the 1950s and 1960s, when white college students joined the fight against Jim Crow laws in the southeastern United States. But these days, many white activists have been challenging racism in themselves and the world around them. Such work is being incorporated in a variety of social movements, including those of multicultural feminism, prison reform, environmental justice, and anti-war. On this roundtable edition of Making Contact, we take a look at what's termed white privilege and white anti-racist activism. I'm Philip Babich, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. Across the United States, white anti-racist activists are asking themselves some hard questions. What is white privilege? How does white privilege affect the agenda of groups and organizations working toward positive social change? And what are some tools and strategies to challenge racism and confront white privilege? To discuss these and other questions, we spoke with the following people. Paul Kivel is the author of Uprooting Racism: How White People Can Work for Racial Justice. He's also the co-founder of the Oakland's Men's Project and has conducted hundreds of workshops on racism and anti-violence. Brooke Atherton does training in anti-racist and anti-war activism with the Heads Up Collective. At the moment, she's coordinating a six-week anti-racist course geared toward white activists. And joining us by phone is Becky Thompson, Associate Professor of Sociology at Simmons College. She's currently teaching in the African-American Studies Department at Duke University in North Carolina. And she's the author of the book, A Promise and a Way of Life, White Anti-Racist Activism. Paul Kivel began the discussion by defining white anti-racist activism.
White anti-racist work is the responsibility of white people addressing the institutionalized racism of our country, the system of policies and practices of the government, the criminal justice system, the healthcare system, the various ways that people of color are discriminated against, exploited, violated, and the role of white people to reach out and challenge that, to work with, to support the leadership of people of color, and to get involved in the community efforts to change those structures.
Mm-hmm. Becky Thompson, what would you add to that?
Well, as is, has been true for so many years, Paul gave a beautiful definition, and I think it speaks so much to all the work that he's been doing for such a long time. But I guess what I would add to that is that I think sometimes people think of anti-racist activism as what goes on in demonstrations and in protests. And of course, that's a piece of doing anti-racist work. But I think a lot of the work also goes on behind closed doors. To me, anti-racist activism is as much about showing up at demonstrations as it is saying and doing things when no one is watching. It's the subtle everyday acts. And some of the reason that I say this is that when I interviewed anti-racist activists, they continually emphasize that in some ways being able to go to the demonstrations is the icing on the cake, and the day-to-day work is the subtle, invisible work that makes a huge difference in the long run.
Mm-hmm. Brooke, you do work on anti-racist issues. Can you talk about what your perspective is on what exactly white anti-racist activism is?
Yes, I mean, I really agree with what Paul and Becky had to say, and I think that for me, there's not necessarily one specific definition because many people do this type of anti-racist work in different ways, but I think for me, the key components are for white activists to look at their social justice work and understand how they can make connections so that in that social justice work, they're working for racial justice. They're challenging the institutions that Paul was speaking to, as well as looking internally to their organizations or how they do their work and challenging the ways that white privilege manifests within that work.
Mm-hmm. So they happen concurrently, you would say, sort of white anti-racist work along or anti-racism work with social justice work?
Yeah, I think they should be very closely intertwined.
Mm-hmm. Has that always been the case, Paul, in activism, say, throughout the decades, say, with the 60s?
Unfortunately not. You know, I think, like Brooke said, they should be hand in hand, because to really address you know, general social inequities, you have to deal with race, just like you have to deal with gender and class and sexual orientation. But so often it's the case that people get involved with a particular issue, like environmental issues, and don't take an anti-racist analysis into it, and they end up doing work that in fact has a negative impact on communities of color. That's why it's important that there be an anti-racist analysis, because otherwise the work for social justice for some groups can actually be a backward step for social justice for other groups.
Hmm. Give us some specific examples of that. How could there be an unintentional negative impact on communities of color?
Well, the largest amount of environmental dumping is in communities of color. And so when the white mainstream environmental justice or environmental movement is working for saving the forests and rainforests and things like that, not taking into account the impact on native communities in those areas or the larger negative impact on communities of color in dumping from mines and timber industries and things like that, then the solutions they're coming up with, the bargaining they're doing with corporations and things like that, can actually have negative impact.
Interesting. Becky Thompson, what's your perspective on the sort of historical nature of white anti-racist work?
I think that the movement that I think of the most immediately that has tried to make links between fighting against racism and sexism and homophobia and classism simultaneously has been the multiracial feminist movement, which really has its origins in the late 1960s. But in terms of historically, I think there's other examples as well of movements that have understood that you can't do one form of anti-oppression work without doing others. And I think, for example, of the founding of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was founded by Ella Baker, who in many ways knew to create an egalitarian and non-hierarchical organization, in part because she had seen the damage done by hierarchies in other anti-racist organizing, and she was very clear that she wanted to create an organization where all people's voices were taken into account. So when I think back in the affirmative to times when people have been able to make links between sexism and racism, for example, I certainly think of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee as a wonderful example of that.
Just to make things a little more clear, I guess, the issue of hierarchy, is there a sort of a linkage between hierarchy and, say, white privilege or white supremacy?
Well, the link in my mind is that white people have historically been the ones in charge in every single institution that Paul mentioned at the opening of the show. And what I'm interested in part, and I think many other people are interested in as well, is how are people able to share power and really hear each other, because, you know, when we talk about anti-racist work as a product, but don't look at how we are interacting with each other on a day-to-day basis, we're kind of missing the whole story. So I guess I take my cue from the feminist theologian Nell Morton, who refers to, she has an adage called, the journey is our home. So to me, that means how are we operating with each other in a democratic way as we're going about trying to make changes.
The group that I do most of my anti-war work with is called Heads Up, and we actually define ourselves as an anti-racist, anti-war group, and came out of a group of white people who were doing anti-racist training together, and after September 11th, wanted a space in which to organize around the war that was separate from the space where we were doing training so that we could focus on organizing, but then continue doing the training in a different space. And from the beginning, we've just defined ourselves as anti-racist and tried to understand what that means in terms of what our practice is as an organization. And I think that was reflected in our goals and sort of how we make decisions, in the sense that we sort of have two goals. One is to work in solidarity with organizations in the Bay Area who are led by folks of color who are doing anti-war work or linking anti-war and local work. And so we're part of coalitions, you know, we have a liaison to groups and ask how they might need support, whether that means setting up for a meeting or, you know, distributing alternative media, you know, sort of seeing how we can support the leadership that's coming out of communities of color around the war. Mm-hmm. And then our other goal is doing anti-racist education work within the more predominantly white activist and anti-war community. Mm-hmm. So far, that's been one-time events. Right now, we're sponsoring a six-week training program, so the training sort of comes back into our work because it's close to all of our hearts. Mm-hmm.
I want to get back to some of the terms that we've been discussing, and one is white privilege. And I want to ask you this, Paul Kibble, about white privilege in terms of how does one realize their white privilege?
Well, it's not all that hard to realize. I mean, if I look at my clothes and think about where they're made by mostly by people of color in this country and overseas, poorly paid and hard working conditions. I look at my computer, my TV, my microwave, all made primarily by people of color. If I look at the food I eat, the land I stand on, the evidence is all around us. We're not used to thinking about that in terms of racism. We think about it as, well, that's just the natural economic system. But in fact, it's the exploitation of people of color, both in this country and overseas. So I think it's the more we talk about it, the more we share our perceptions with each other, the more we get better at identifying where racism is operating.
Yeah. I think, too, that part of why I think it's important to have these examples is that since the 1960s, oftentimes some of the most egregious forms of discrimination occur without those terms being used, because many people know now not to use swear words that are racist, to not be upfront about their discrimination, and so it's done through code. So I think that having examples is a way for us to recognize how white supremacy continues to be upheld. And just an example I'd like to tag on to what Brooke was talking about, I'm actually talking to you from Duke University, where I'm teaching in the African and African American Studies Department for the year, and there were two rapes on campus, and the suspect, actually there was more, but there were two that were highly publicized, and the suspect was considered an African-American man, and there was a composite sketch of the alleged rapist put up all over campus. Now, for domestic violence and rape activists, it was so important that there be publicity that the rapes had occurred, that the university not attempt to make the rapes invisible. So on the one level, you can see why it was important to get the word out about the rapes having happened. But when they put an image of a black man up all over as the alleged suspect, that ended up incriminating, because of racism, all the black men on campus. And the question that had to then be asked was, how come they chose to put a composite sketch of a black man up all over, but when there was a white fraternity student who was accused of rape, his picture was not plastered all over as well? So in that moment, domestic violence activists and rape activists were organizing around issues of gender, but of course needing to see the race implications as well, which meant needing to protest, you know, both publicly and in newspapers and in networking, the reasons why using composite sketches of African-American suspects is particularly dangerous in a white supremacist country.
It's so often we have to be, whatever the public policy issue, whatever the situation is, we have, unless we come with an explicit analysis of how racism impacts it, we're going to be inevitably misled and not being able to really work fully for the empowerment of the community, because the racism is so deeply embedded in our culture that we almost automatically go to that place of white privilege, white superiority.
That's the voice of Paul Kibble, author of Uprooting Racism, How White People Can Work for Racial Justice. Also joining us is Becky Thompson, author of A Promise and a Way of Life, White Anti-Racist Activism, and Brooke Atherton with the Heads Up Collective. We'll have more of this discussion in a moment. You are listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you would like more information about the subject of this week's program, or you would like to contact any of our guests, please give us a call. It's toll-free, 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. That's radioproject.org. We now continue our discussion on white anti-racist activism with Paul Kibble, Brooke Atherton, and Becky Thompson.
I think for so many white people, we start with, well, maybe it's operating or maybe it's not. We really need to assume that racism is operating. We know that it's a foundation of all of our culture. So instead of saying, asking ourselves, is it operating, we need to ask ourselves the question, how is it operating?
Yeah, and I agree with that. And I think I just add in terms of the types of questions people need to ask themselves. For me, looking historically is really important. Through the Challenging White Supremacy workshops, I sort of learned a history that I had never been taught around the creation of white privilege, and talking about in the 1700s when white indentured servants and African slaves were uniting and revolting against the plantation owners, who they hugely outnumbered. The plantation owners had to figure out how to prevent that that type of rebellion. And so they made all these different European immigrants white in law in the late 1700s. And at the same time, they encoded slavery in law so that they gave the privilege of potential freedom at some point, the possibility to own land, the opportunity, quote unquote, to be on the slave patrol to European immigrants who are now all called white. And then for African slaves, they put into law the practices around if you're born to a slave, you are a slave. And they also put into law severe restrictions on any interaction between the African slaves and the white sort of working class at the time. And so to look at that history, at the ways in which the creation of white privilege, I mean, it really is, it's something that is given to one people and taken from another, is really important. And then to look at that for each of us, I think studying our own family history for white people is really important, to ask, where did my European ancestors come from? What did they do when they came to this country? Did they own land? Who gave them that land? How did they get that land? You know, for me to learn about my own family's use of the Homestead Act, which gave European settlers access to land that was Native American land and that was even denied to other immigrants of color, you know, to realize that that's part of like my family's experience and my privilege and opportunity now is based in that foundation hundreds of years ago, has been a really powerful way for me to understand white privilege in a historical context.
My whole family on both sides is Mormon, and on one side is polygamous, and which meant that my great-great-grandfather had 9 wives. And the story handed down is that each of those wives were, quote, given a tract of land in Utah. Now, given, if we look at it in terms of historical accuracy, was actually they took over native land. So polygamy was not only about sexism, but it was also about racism, because it was about the annihilation of a people's way of life by taking over native land in Utah and in Arizona as well. But I wanted to just tag onto an earlier question about examples of white privilege, and try to throw into the soup an example from internationally. And I'm really taking my cue here from Nelson Mandela, who did an interview that was published widely, where he talked about what does it mean that, in fact, the United States is the biggest threat to world peace that we're looking at now. And the example he gave is that the United States feels quite comfortable in attempting to reprimand, intervene, and invade a black country in the Middle East while not calling on the carpet a white country that would be Israel in the same region that has far more capacity in terms of weapons of mass destruction. And so, again, I think, I have historically looked at African-Americans, two African-Americans, because so many of the times, and black people all over the world who have been so insightful in recognizing the power dynamics around race, because oftentimes in the media I don't hear, well, we're really looking at a race issue here in terms of Iraq being what essentially is a black country being invaded by a white supremacist country.
Do you think it's an overriding assumption, at least in the mass media, Becky Thompson, that we've gotten over racism, so we don't need to address those questions?
Well, not only in the mass media, but I'm taking 2 courses here at Duke as well as teaching this year, which is a delightful experience on many levels to be a student again, but also just to see the level of misinformation among undergraduates to the point where so many of them have accepted so many deep notions that racism is somehow over, that we no longer need affirmative action. And again, I feel myself crying inside. My heart is pounding because this is only the first generation when we're not living under such strict codes of legalized segregation. And of course, it's going to take more than one generation to be able to address the deep issues of inequality. So we're needing to talk about affirmative action as something that needs at least 100 years. And again, I look to South Africa because they have in their constitution understood affirmative action as a central piece of democracy.
Paula Kivell, I wanted to ask you this. Our society is so multicultural, and relatively few people may neatly fall into a quote-unquote white category, you know, meaning that they're not what we may assume, white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, or WASP, meaning white, or they're not donning a white hood and going to KKK meetings. Mm-hmm. How do you address that, the multicultural issue and whiteness?
Well, I think there's two parts of that. One is that there are many more mixed heritage people and people in mixed racial families, and that's a significant factor. The other, though, is the practical reality that I have a Jewish, Russian, Polish background. So, you know, I'm not WASP. I'm not that Christian white. But when I walk down the street, I'm not followed. I'm not stopped the way my African-American and Latino colleagues are. When I walk into the store, I'm treated with respect. And when my friends of color walk in, they're followed around and assumed to be shoplifters. When I drive down the highway, I'm not pulled over by the highway patrol. So, you know, there's a practical reality of how I'm treated, how I'm viewed by the institutions of the society. And in that sense, I think we fall on one side of that line or another. And some of us may be close enough that sometimes we fall on one side or another. But most of us are pretty clear about where we fall and how we're treated by the institutions and by the agents of those institutions. And that's really the dividing line.
I agree with what you're saying, Paul, just about in terms of the line around like how you're treated when you walk down the street or, you know, how you pass per se. But I think the diversity among white people is an important thing for at least people doing white anti-racist organizing in white communities to be paying attention to. I know in the workshops I've been doing, we've been trying to do a better job of incorporating a class analysis along with our anti-racist analysis and not make an assumption that all white people experience white privilege in the same way that someone we may share certain experiences of white privilege around like what happens when we drive down the highway, but other aspects of white privilege can be mediated by religion or by class or by sexuality or gender. And trying to incorporate that is challenging because we don't want to sidetrack and only focus on our own differences. We need to focus on anti-racism, but we have to be looking at both at once, which is a real challenge.
And I just believe that nuance is really important to have, partly in order to not alienate people who don't resonate with the same experiences, but also because someone may be a very light-skinned Latina and therefore will be, you know, granted some access that she would not be if she were darker-skinned. But the minute she speaks with an accent, already there are forms of discrimination that she's quite susceptible to. So I think with the increased diversity, you know, in the United States and the immigration from Central and South America being such an important piece of U.S. heritage and also currently, that adding accent discrimination to the mix of the ways in which people are discriminated against and how English-speaking dominance continues to uphold those who are monolingual in positions of power. I think that piece is an important piece to add to the mix.
Becky Thompson, you interviewed, I think, hundreds of people on this topic. And what was the range of responses to the question as to whether someone identified themselves as being a, quote, white anti-racist activist?
Well, I actually didn't interview hundreds, although I in many ways wish I could have, because doing the interviews with the 40 people that I did talk with was an extraordinary experience for me, because I was able to go all over the country and meet with people who are, you know, for the most part, an incredibly humble and animated and enthusiastic and powerful group who just keep doing the work over the long run. But what I continue to hear from them is, through their humility, a deep sense of being cautious of the term anti-racist, the term white, and the term activist. And some of the reason for that is that some of the people believe that to call themselves an activist when we don't have vibrant social movements is disrespectful to those who really laid their lives on the line at a point when there were social movements like from the 1960s and the 1970s. But also there was great concern about referring to themselves as anti-racist. Some of them felt that that was quite presumptuous. Horace Selden, who's one of the elders of the people who I spoke with, who is one of the founders of Community Change, which is an anti-racist organization in Boston, refers to himself as a racist anti-racist. And the reason he does that is he feels like he's always in recovery from racism, that he's never going to be able to, quote, get it right. And as a consequence, he feels as if to say he was anti-racist is to assume that he's arrived at a point that he's not going to be able to be at. And there's something very honest to me about that presentation. It's like men who talk about themselves as recovering from sexism, I feel a lot more comfortable with than men who somehow think they've got it all together and they know all the answers.
Paul, is there a point at which we would be recovered from racism?
Well, I don't think so, in the sense that we're bombarded continually with reinforcement. I think the analogy with sexism is good because, you know, for a while as a man, when I was working with men around sexism, I thought, well, I'm cured. I just have to get them over on my side. And I kept coming up against ways that I wasn't cured, that I was acting out with patterns of, you know, assumptions of superiority from being male. So, you know, it's a lifelong process personally, but that doesn't mean that we can't start now doing the things in the community to make a change. We just have to pay attention to doing both levels of work at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And I think that piece about as imperfect and as limited as the work can be, nevertheless, it's still important, is some of the reason why I wanted to write A Promise and a Way of Life to begin with. I kept wondering, why is it that progressives in this country seem to feel more comfortable, in a way, focusing on issues of racism than anti-racism? I mean, to what extent is telling the history of racism over and over again a way to try to attain some notion of innocence, that if I tell the story of racism enough times, then others will see me as innocent, as not part of the problem? But if we turn the tables on that and say, let's look at the history of anti-racism among white people, as limited as it's been, as narrow as it's been, as small in terms of its impact as it's been, to have a history of anti-racism among white people says, yes, it is possible to do that. It makes it so that it's not possible for people to, you know, to be off the hook and say, well, it never happened in the past, and it's certainly not happening in the present, and therefore, how am I ever going to do anything in the future? It's rather, okay, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to fall on my face, it's going to be hard, I'll probably feel lonely, I won't say it exactly right, and I'm going to try again.
For me, fighting for racial justice is about collective liberation. You can't, I mean, this was stated at the beginning, I don't think it's possible to fight against any oppression without fighting them all and working for a world in which we aren't bound by these hierarchies based on race or sex or class. And I think that for white people, we need to put a special focus on fighting for racial justice as part of our own collective liberation. And
nice.
I really encourage people to look and see, how does that make sense to them? How, you know, how does racism affect you? So that I think as more and more white people can fight against racial injustice and fight for racial justice from a point of their own self-interest in collective liberation, the more powerful our movements against, the more powerful the white portion of movements against racism can be.
Excellent.
Mazel tov.
That was the voice of Brooke Atherton. She's with the Heads Up Collective. On the phone with us is Becky Thompson, author of A Promise and a Way of Life, White Anti-Racist Activism. And in the studio with us is Paul Kivel, author of Uprooting Racism, How White People Can Work for Racial Justice. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact, a look at white anti-racist activism. Thanks for listening. If you would like more information about the subject of this week's program, or if you would like to contact any of our guests, please call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. That's radioproject.org. Making Contact is an independent production. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you have suggestions for future programs, we'd love to hear from you. Laura Levati is our acting executive director, Peggy Law, founding director, associate producer Amy Pomerlo, women's desk director Lisa Rudman, administrative coordinator Rosalind Fay, executive assistant Susanna Hines, senior advisor Norman Solomon, national producer David Barsamian, and I'm your host and managing producer Philip Babbage. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Until next time,